village, and the woman asked him about school and his friends. She gave him another juice box and asked about his mother. He said he hadn't seen her since February. They drove to a neighborhood where the people were Chinese, and there were Chinese stores and restaurants. But it wasn't Manhattan Chinatown. There were more trees here, houses with aluminum siding, children riding bikes on the sidewalks. The woman parked the van on a side street. They got out, walked to a three-story house, and rang a bell. A man and a woman answered the door, both Chinese and with graying hair. The four of them walked upstairs to an apartment, and the black woman spoke to the Chinese woman in the kitchen, but Dumming couldn't hear their words, while the man sat with him on a couch in the cool front room, saying, "Relax, be good," until Dumming fell asleep on the cushions, drained from the heat and the car ride. When he woke up, the black woman was gone.
"How long will I stay here?"
he asked the man.
"A while,"
the man said. They fed him vegetables and beef stew, big bowlfuls of it. He asked if he could call Michael, and they said not now, later. They turned up the air conditioner and let him sleep and watch TV. Days passed. Dumming lost track of time. He slept on the couch and watched TV. Afternoons, alone in the apartment, he roamed the small rooms, opening empty drawers and cabinets, eating Chef Boyardee that he heated in the microwave. The couple's bedroom remained locked. There was no telephone. He wanted to go outside, but the front door was locked too. One morning, when the doorbell rang, it wasn't Vivian and Michael, but a white man and woman, who spoke to the Chinese woman in English. The white woman said Dumming's name first.
"Di Ming. Di Ming."
She drew the vowels out so the word was unrecognizable. The Chinese woman said,
"Dumming."
And he sat up, still sleepy. The white woman tried again, closer this time. They approached on tiptoe.
"Hello, Dumming."
The man's voice was reedy, gently nasal. His hair was floppy with light yellow strands, and his eyes were a diluted blue, surrounded by lines. The white woman's hair was short, blonde with chunks of brown. Her cheeks were a pale pink.
"Hello, Dumming."
They sat on either side of him. The woman's arms touched his. The man's legs pressed against his. He had only been so close to white people on the subway before.
"Who are these people?"
he asked the Chinese woman in Mandarin.
"These are your new foster parents," she said in English. "Peter and Kay Wilkinson."
Dumming jumped up. Peter and Kay Wilkinson were tall, but he was fast. He made it halfway down the carpeted stairs before he felt hands on him.
"Stop, Dumming."
It was the Chinese woman.
"The Americans will take good care of you. They have a big house and lots of money."
"I already have a family."
"Your old family isn't here anymore. This is your new family. Relax. Everything will be okay."
Peter and Kay Wilkinson squatted on the steps.
"Dumming," Kay said. "We're going to take care of you. It's going to be okay."
She put her arms around him. Her shirt smelled like laundry and soap. His mother had been gone for half a year. And now Leon and Vivian were gone too. Nobody wanted him. Dumming leaned against Kay and she stroked his hair.
"There," she said,
victorious, and she laughed, a peal of delight, a flag unfurled in the sun.
It'll be okay.
He followed the Wilkinsons out of the house. On the drive upstate, he fell asleep and missed his last glimpse of the city. Woke up in a car parked in front of a large white house with a wraparound porch. Tall trees looming. In the city, it had been one of those steam chamber August afternoons that felt like dying. But here, in the shade, it was cold. Peter turned off the engine.
Welcome home.
4. 1 week later, tucked into a double bed sheathed with red flannel, Deming Guo awoke with the crumbs of dialect on his tongue, smudges and smears of dissolving syllables, nouns and verbs washed out to sea. One language had outseeped another. New York City had provided him with an arsenal of new words. He'd bled English vowels and watched his mother's face fall. He wrapped the blankets tighter around him. Cold even in late August. The white clabbered house in Ridgeboro, New York. Population 6,525. 5 hours northwest of the city. Was nearly 200 years old, Peter said. An antique. 5 times the size of the Bronx apartment. 7 times the size of the house on Three Alley. 3 big bedrooms. One for Kay and Peter, one for Deming, and the third for guests. A bed chubby with quilts and pillows in which nobody ever slept. 2 bathrooms and 2 floors and a whole room for eating, another for studying and working on the computer. A breeze snaked in through the oversized windows. The beanbags that lay across the bottoms of doors could not ward off this draft.
I am Daniel Wilkinson. He shivered.
He had never slept alone before. Never had a room to himself. All this vast, empty space. Deming heard a toot-toot of a whistle. Peter was in the doorframe, hands on hips. He liked to whistle tunelessly.
Good morning, Daniel.
It always took a second to realize they were talking to him. When school started, they said, it would be easier with an American name. Though it wasn't official. His birth certificate, Kay explained, still said Deming Guo.
Time to get up now. We'll be leaving for church in an hour and a half.
From downstairs wafted breakfasty odors. Eggs and sausage and salty grease. Deming's stomach rumbled. In those early days he called them nothing. Spoke to them without saying either Kay and Peter or Mom and Dad. When Kay leaned in for hugs, Deming wiggled away. Her hold too tight. The Wilkinsons smelling like cheese and flowers. Bitter and sugary sweet. But other times he lingered. We're glad you're here, Daniel. She would say in English, then perform shapeless approximations of Mandarin words. She had learned some Chinese phrases, taken Mandarin classes, and bought a Chinese-English dictionary. But her tones were so off-kilter that Deming couldn't understand what she was saying.
I don't know who you are, he'd respond in Fujianese.
When he spoke Chinese, Peter's leg would bounce and Kay's lips would press even thinner, as if they were being sucked into her body, her mouth consuming itself.
English,
Peter would warn, concerned that Deming wouldn't be fluent enough for school, as if the English he spoke was tainted. His mother used to swat at his shoulders in a way that looked playful but felt serious when he spoke too much English and not enough Chinese. His weapon of choice had been the language that made her dependent on him. Whoever she was with now would have to translate. The giant windows. The yard outside with its large, gnarled trees. No sidewalks on Oak Street. Hours could pass without a car going by. The absence of overt sound, a trickle of gauzy peach. Dumming would stand at the window and listen to the languid chirp of birds, the dim roar of a distant lawnmower. The air maintained a steady, nearly indiscernible buzz. Peach-brown gauze swept over his eyelashes. In a corner of his new room was a pile-up of plastic games, action figures of muscular men with swords, sturdy fire trucks and police cars with miniature sirens. Toys Peter and Kay said were his. Playing cops didn't interest him. There was nothing fun about screeching sirens. On a shelf by his bed was a row of books. Condensed classics for children. Paperback versions of The Count of Monte Cristo, The Last of the Mohicans, and Oliver Twist. The word condensed reminded him of the cans of milk his mother had bought him as a treat. A drizzle of sugared glue atop his breakfast oatmeal. Like him, she had a sweet tooth, but didn't give in to it often. Eduardo would offer her damp muffins encased in plastic wrap, the blueberries reminiscent of pigeon poop. But she would buy bananas instead. Occasionally there had been condensed milk, Tootsie Rolls, a package of Twizzlers. Full of omelet, Dumming fidgeted in the pews of St. Anne's. The collared striped shirt, a hand-me-down from a nephew of Kay's, made his neck itch. Stand, sit, pray. The priest droned on, and Dumming gripped the blue button from his mother's box. He had found it inside a pair of shorts Vivian had packed. Now he slept with it under his pillow. He rubbed the button's hard upper lip, the rounded center, and remembered the subway as it shot out of the underground at 125th Street, and his mother with her arms around him, saying, "Look!" He dreamt of dashing up University with Michael, where the street curved and the buildings slapped hands with the sky, legs swinging, backpacks bouncing, sharing a bag of Funyuns with Elroy and Hung, shoving Sop Heap around in the park. The pizzeria, the donut spot, the Chinese takeout, the shop selling rows of stiff blue jeans and dresses for $4.99. In the city, far, far away from St. Anne's Church, and the town so small you could spit on a map and rub it away. There had always been the warm press of bodies, Vivian ladling bowls of soup, the chatter of the television, chugging soda, burping contests with Michael, his mother talking on her cell phone. Sharing a bed, it had been warm enough to not need flannel blankets or wool socks. He tried to tuck away the Bronx in scraps and shards. Once he had read in a book, an ancient science textbook still being passed off as usable at PS33. "One day man will walk on the moon," it said, more than a quarter century after the fact. That people could have tumors inside them for years. Harmless cysts. And these cysts could grow teeth and hair, even fingernails. A person could carry this alien being and never know. A monster twin. A hairball double. So many things could be growing inside him. Inside every person. He carried Mama and Leon. Michael and Vivian. The city. Reduced to a series of hairs. A ball of fingernail clippings and one stray tooth. A collection of secret tumors. Dumming kicked the pew. A little girl in the next row turned around and looked at his face until her mother elbowed her. The minister mumbled a prayer. Dumming had never been to church before, so he did what everyone else was doing. He stood. He sat. He recited lines from the heavy book and stifled a yawn. "Thank you, God. Amen. He tried to ignore the people around him as he walked with the Wilkinsons to their car. Ridgeboro Middle School was 2 blocks from downtown Ridgeboro, which consisted of 1 main street and a park with a big American flag. Dumming sat in the front seat of Kay's silver Prius on the drive down Oak Street, then Hillside Road, across the railroad tracks and into the west side of town, where the houses were closer together and the yards were smaller.
"Daniel might be better served if he does the 5th grade over again instead of going into the 6th. Across the board, his grades were very poor."
Principal Chester, a man with tufts of white nose hairs that protruded from his nostrils like grassy tusks, pointed to papers on his desk.
"It seems that this school, this Bronx school, also recommended him for special study."
"I did summer school," Dumming said.
"We'll need records for that, then."
Principal Chester looked through the papers.
"They didn't have the same classes we do here. What kind of math and science did you take at your old school, young man?"
He wondered how Principal Chester could breathe through the nose hairs, and wished Michael and his friends were here so they could joke about them.
"Just math."
"Geometry? And what about language arts? What did you study at your old school?"
He looked at Kay.
"Where is he from, originally?"
"I already told you," Kay said. "New York City."
"But originally?"
"His mother, I guess, was Chinese."
"China. Interesting. And you and your husband are his adoptive parents?"
"Foster," Kay said. Principal Chester shuffled papers.
"His English may need a little brushing up on. But I'm afraid we don't have enough foreign students in this school district to warrant an English as a second language class."
"His English is perfectly fine. He was born here."
"It would be beneficial to let him be with the 5th graders. Kids can get discouraged easily. We don't want to get him started off in his new country on the wrong foot."
"As I mentioned, he was born in the United States," Kay said. "And you can hear him talk. He's fluent." "I don't agree with holding him back. It will only impart low expectations. Kids are adaptable. They learn fast. He belongs with the other kids his age, in the 6th grade.
"And your husband? Does he agree with all this?"
"Excuse me?"
"Certainly your husband has an opinion as well,"
Principal Chester said. "Developmentally, Daniel is academically above grade level. If you recall Vygotsky, as an educator like yourself surely can, then you are aware that social interaction is fundamentally tied to a child's cognitive development processes. Even if your school employs a transmissionist model, we can take into account that scaffolding teaching strategies among Daniel's peer group will ensure that he can, and will, thrive in the appropriate sociocultural context. In other words, in the 6th grade. Principal Chester looked at the papers again.
"Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves,"
he chuckled.
"All that talk about models. I'm not sure I'm as well-versed in models as you are, Mrs. Wilkinson."
"Dr. Wilkinson, I teach at Carlo." In the end, Principal Chester put Dumming in 6th grade. "That man's a complete idiot," Kay said, as they left the school. Dumming's first weeks in Ridgeboro were like sleepwalking, murky and addled, as if he'd wake up and be back in the Bronx with a finger snap. The bag of clothing Vivian had packed was the only thing he had left from the city. clothes Kay had washed and folded and placed in the dresser in his room. She took him to the mall to buy what she called a proper back-to-school wardrobe. The parking lot a wide expanse of blacktop bigger than any lot he had ever seen. Its size more apparent because of its emptiness. Only a few cars parked in the myriad spaces. They walked past stores as soprano saxophone trilled over the loudspeakers. And like at church, like the few people he'd seen on Oak Street, everyone else was white. They passed stands selling jewelry, watches, baseball caps. "Let's see," Kay said. "What would an 11-year-old boy wear?" She stopped in front of Hollister, Abercrombie and Fitch. "Do you like these stores?"
"I don't know," Deming said.
Inside Abercrombie and Fitch were life-sized cardboard teenagers romping on a beach, girls with sun-streaked hair laughing in bikinis, and boys holding surfboards against their muscled torsos. His mother had bought his clothes on Fordham Road, he and Michael getting two of the same shirt in different sizes and colors.
"Look,"
Kay pointed to the cardboard cutouts.
"It must hurt to smile like that."
She bared her teeth and struck the same pose as one of the bikini girls, thighs lunging, arms raised. Deming watched her, not sure if he was supposed to laugh. Cargo pants. Boys' shirts. Classic tees. Chinos, polos, hoodies. Kay held up clothing and Deming said,
"Okay."
In the dressing room, he removed his green shorts and gray t-shirt, took off the Yankees cap Leon had given him. Michael had the same pair of shorts in blue and a striped version of the gray shirt. Did Michael miss him? Or was he glad to have the bed to himself? Leon might have called from China. If Vivian moved, his mother would have no way of getting in touch with her. To let him know where she was. Heart pounding. He zipped on cargo pants. He looked in the mirror and felt weird. Misshaped. "Can you come out here and show me?" Kay gave him a brief once-over. "Do you like them? Do they fit?"
"Yeah."
"So, do you want them? And these shirts here, I guess, too?"
"Okay."
Kay handed the cashier a piece of paper and said she had a clothing voucher for foster children.
"We don't take these," the woman said. "Try Walmart or Target."
"Oh!"
Kay laughed.
"It's okay."
She put the paper back in her purse and took out her credit card. After signing the receipt, the shirts and pants folded inside a bag, she asked Deming, "Do you need anything else?" Deming was puzzled at the enormity of the question.
"What about sneakers?"
he finally said. Kay's hand flew to her forehead.
"Come on, Kay, get it together. Shoes! How can I forget about shoes? Can't go to a school barefoot. Principal Chester would not approve."
At the athlete's foot, Deming picked the most expensive pair of Nikes on the shelf, with puffy tongues and red and black stripes. Kay handed over her credit card and signed. What else could she buy him? A motorcycle? A computer? They wandered upstairs to the food court. Kay held the clothing bags, Deming the box with his new sneakers, and they shared a plate of cheese fries. He licked the hot yellow sauce from between the ridges of each fry. Crinkle cut. They were called. "Did you go to malls in New York City?" Kay's skin had become pinker, perhaps from the heat of the fries. Deming looked at families eating at other tables, old couples walking arm in arm, teenagers counting change and pouring sodas.
"Why am I here?"
Kay picked up a fry.
"Because we have room for a child in our family.
and you needed a family to stay with.
She grew even pinker.
Are you nervous about school?
Not really.
At a nearby table sat a mother with two boys around his age. All of them soft and oversized. Even their teeth were big, doing diligent damage to a pizza. He accidentally made eye contact with one of the boys, who glanced at his brother and snickered. Their mother stared at Kay and Deming as if they were standing on the street with their butts exposed. He grabbed more fries and tried to ignore the family at the other table.
He wanted to like Kay's laughter, its bursting crescendo, and the easy way she bought him things.
She kept talking.
I know it's scary, being the new kid. My family moved once when I was in 7th grade, just 2 towns over, but it was a new school and I thought it was the end of the world. Literally. That my world was going to end. It wasn't that I liked my old school so much, not at all, but I was scared it would be worse. But you know what? I ended up making friends. Which was a miracle in itself. I mean, I was such a nerdy kid. A bespectacle bookworm. I loved reading so much I'd stay up all night with books and fall asleep in class the next day. I'd even stay inside during recess to read. As you can imagine, that didn't win me any popularity awards.
But you're going to be okay, Daniel. You're going to be fine.
On the first day of 5th grade at PS33, Mama and Vivian had walked Deming and Michael out the door of their building. All along the block were kids streaming out of their own buildings. Big kids, little kids, sisters and brothers, and at the light was a crossing guard, a Puerto Rican lady who always said, "Good morning, sweethearts," in a sugary alto. Ridgeboro Middle School seemed miles away from Kay and Peter's house. He heard them talking on the other side of his bedroom wall.
"It sounds horrible, but maybe a younger child would have been easier,"
Kay said.
"More of a blank slate."
"We waited years for a younger child,"
Peter said,
"even when we were still thinking about China."
"I know, but I can't figure out how to act around him sometimes."
"Be yourself. Aren't children supposed to know if you're not being natural?"
"You're at school all day. Are you sure you can't work here at least part of the time? We have a study. You can write there."
"Let's not go through all this again," Peter said. "You know this is an important semester for me."
"It's not like they're going to decide to not make you department chair because you come home early once in a while. Work-life balance. You've been there forever. They know you and your work. That's not about to change."
"Not with Valerie in the running. She has no kids to worry about and one more book than I do. I have to work more right now, not less."
"Honey, really?"
"There's no work-life balance when it comes to academia. You, of all people, should know that. But it could be different for women. There aren't the same expectations, the same drive."
"Right!"
Kay laughed.
"We don't have drive. We're expected to do all of the childcare, and all of the cooking, and go to work, and teach, and do research, and write our own books. We're expected to support our husbands, make sure they're taken care of so they can do their very important work. And lucky me! I get to be adjunct forever."
"Well, you wanted this. And now you have it."
"Oh, that is not fair. You wanted it, too."
It was quiet. If Kay left Peter for another man, would Deming have to go back to the city?
"You did want it,"
Kay said.
"Right?" "Of course.
Do you think we're going to be okay at this?
Of course, Peter said. That's the advantage of fostering. We can try it on for size. See what happens.
I'm afraid to get too attached. The aunt or the mother, they could come back for him any time.
We'll take it day by day.
It's not that I think that success in parenting is biological. But it's hard. It doesn't come naturally. Though I hate to use such an essentialist term.
It takes time. It'll be better once he goes to school. He'll make friends. You'll see.
I want him to open up to me. Tell me about his mother, or the city, or anything.
He's been through a lot. Don't push it.
There was another silence, and Deming was backing away from the wall when he heard Peter say,
"Maybe it's cultural. Why, he's more reserved."
Maybe. Maybe. Oh, are we crazy? Having him live in a town with no other Asian kids? I wouldn't blame him if he hated us.
I'm not going to say it'll be easy, said Peter. But white, black, purple, green, kids of all races have struggles with belonging. They're fat, or their parents don't have a lot of money.
That's true, Kay said. I was a bookworm with glasses. I never belonged in my hometown.
Issues are colorblind.
If things work out, we'll have to make sure we connect him with his culture. I'll talk to Elaine about that summer camp.
We'll take care of him. That's all that matters. And he knows that.
Deming pressed his ear against the wall. But Peter's words faded into mush. His mother was short and round and nothing like Kay.
Don't think about her.
His mother talked with her hands and let him watch as much TV as he wanted.
Don't think about that.
Kay and Peter only allowed 3 hours of TV per week. They preferred PBS. The kitchen smelled like milk farts and meat. Kay heaped Deming's plate with meatloaf, gravy, and Brussels sprouts and filled his glass with cold skim milk. Milk gave Deming stomach aches, but Peter said it was good for him, so he drank a glass at every meal. He made sure to set the dinner table the way Kay taught him. Forks and knives in the right order. No spoons. Napkins and placemats centered. Glasses in their proper corners. The other night, he saw Kay move the glass he'd placed in front of her placemat from the left corner to the right.
Right, not left.
Don't screw up again.
One more day of summer and it's back to school for all of us, Peter said.
Classes started tomorrow at Ridgeboro Middle and Carlo College, where Peter taught economics and Kay taught political science. Deming wedged meatloaf against the side of his cheek. If he gave in to the Wilkinsons, he would be stuck here with them. His real family forever lost. Kay turned to him.
Daniel?
Peter's gaze joined hers.
Are you looking forward to school tomorrow?
I guess so.
Daniel, please look at us when we're talking to you, Peter said.
Kay's lips pressed and creased.
We love you, Daniel.
He forked another chunk of meatloaf. His mother said she had wanted big things for herself. But then she had him. If he could love Peter and Kay, they could leave too. They had been waiting for a younger child who would have been easier, whom they had wanted more. Late at night, Deming crept downstairs to the kitchen telephone. He remembered his mother's cell phone number, though he'd never memorized Leon's or Vivian's.
and there was no landline in the Bronx apartment.
He lifted the receiver, pressed the numbers, and heard an automated message tell him he needed to dial a 1. He tried again with a 1. There was a pause. Another announcement.
This call cannot be completed at this time.
He called again, switching the order of the last two numbers, and the phone rang but went to a strange man's voicemail. The first number was the right one. He hadn't forgotten. But his mother wasn't there. Upstairs, the toys in the corner of his room formed a shadow. Deming made out the shapes of a fire truck, a police car, and put one vehicle in front of the other and pushed them across the rug. He rammed the fire truck into the police car and whispered the sound of sirens.
On the first day of school, Kay made a special breakfast, blueberry pancakes with maple syrup.
She dropped Dumming off on her way to Carlo, and he summoned his best don't-mess-with-me face, walked into Mrs. Lumpkin's homeroom class, and found a seat. The classroom was bigger than the ones in PS 33, and instead of sitting at tables in groups of four, kids in Ridgeboro sat at individual chairs attached to desks. Mrs. Lumpkin called roll, and Daniel Wilkinson was the last name called.
"Here,"
he said. 24 pairs of eyes looked over. Mrs. Lumpkin, who was skinny despite her name, double-checked the roster. At PS 33 there'd been 32 kids in his homeroom, but at Ridgeboro Middle, there were only 50 kids in the whole sixth grade. Dumming sat through history and science and language arts. Alone at a cafeteria table, he ate the turkey sandwich, celery sticks, and hard, crisp apple Kay had packed. Everyone he saw was the same color except for him, and their silence seeped into the air like a threat. At home after school, Dumming stared at the noiseless street, heard the same blank buzz, and felt a sickening loss. He punched the wall as hard as he could.
"You call that a punch? That's a handshake!"
Until his knuckles were screaming, and he was screaming too. The house was empty. Peter and Kay were at work. When they were home, he was forced to keep a straight face, but it felt like he was being skinned alive. On the second day of school, Dumming decided he had been imported from another planet to come to Planet Ridgeboro. He was not aware of the length of his assignment, only that one day he would be sent home. This was how he got himself through the hours. He studied Amber Bitburger, who sat in front of him in homeroom and whose long blonde hair had white strands interspersed throughout, a yellow-brown closer to the scalp that lightened progressively toward the ends. Her skin visible beneath, pink and soft, like a baby animal before the fur comes in. Her eyes were a gray-green, her face a range of hills, nose, chin, cheekbones. They were big. Dumming was big, too. He'd been one of the biggest Asian kids at PS 33. But they were different. Had never noticed the way they looked to other people, because there were no other people present. Here, they paid too much attention to him, at first, and later, they would pay no attention to him. It was that kind of mindfuck. To be too visible and invisible at the same time, in the ways it mattered the most. Too obvious to the boys who wanted to mock him. Yet girls would only notice him when he was walking around with his fly down. He studied their noses. Some were pointy, others drooping like overripe fruit. Some nostrils flared up and out, while others were pinched and narrow. The boys and girls separated into distinct clusters at recess, with the crumbs, the leftover kids who didn't belong to any group, scattered along the margins of the playground. Dumming could see he was a crumb. Crumbs didn't want to be noticed, but were as noticeable as an open sore, tucking themselves away to avoid the places of highest concentration. The jungle gym. The corners of the blacktop where girls congregated. The basketball court and soccer field that were home to boys who were good at sports. If the crumbs were successful at hiding from others, they weren't fooling each other. They lashed out at the nearest targets, happy to train that spotlight 2 feet over to the left. But Dumming did not want to hide. Three Alley and the Bronx had prepped him, and Planet Ridgeboro was the ultimate test. He had been specifically placed on this mission by his superiors to test his strength and patience. When he fulfilled his mission, he would be reunited with his real family. Who were his supervisors? He had figured that out, too. They communicated, telepathically, in Fujonese, the language he didn't have to try to hear. This mission made him brave. So he got out on the blacktop at recess, out there in the open, daring anyone to mess with him. On the third day, a girl stopped at Dumming's table in the cafeteria, clutching a box of apple juice with a scrawny straw, teeth marks flattening the tip. Her dark hair was pulled into a stubby ponytail. Her glasses had bright red frames.
"Where are you from?"
Dumming cleared his throat.
"The Bronx. Where are you from?"
"I'm from here,"
she said, and walked away.
On the fourth day, there was Jim. In Ridgeboro, kids played sports. Football, soccer, basketball, swimming, baseball, tennis, volleyball, hockey. Ridgeboro boys were supposed to charge and ram.
Dumming observed the youth of Planet Ridgeboro in the boys' locker room as they changed into gym clothes. From the unformed baby limbs of short kids like Sean Wecker, the crummiest of crumbs, to the meaty paws and frankenhead of Cody Campbell. He studied Cody's plump hands, thighs like pork roasts, the waggle and sweat of Cody's chins. He took off his shoes. Took off the athletic shorts Kay had bought. The crumbs stayed on the edges of rows, scuttling to change without being noticed. But the other boys joked and yelled out to their friends. Sean Wecker, his foot tangled in the fabric of his shorts, stumbled into a locker. He was a small boy with a shriveled face, so pale he'd been nicknamed Ghost.
"Fag,"
one of the other boys said.
"Ghost is a fag." "Fuck you!"
Sean yelled back.
"Fuck you!"
The locker room's collective response was laughter. So much worse than anger. And Sean slunk away. Then Dumming felt the shove. A blow between his shoulder blades. He tipped forward. It was Cody.
"What are you looking at? Chinese retard."
On the side of his face was a flying saucer-shaped mole. He pushed Dumming again. But this time Dumming charged Cody and knocked him backwards. Cody stumbled, making a sound like,
"Oof!"
He was less graceful than even Travis Bopa. He was big but lacked balance. This struck Dumming as both comic and predictable. There was a weight on him, a jab in his side. One elbow, then another. Dumming cried out, and the weight rolled off. Cody collected himself. Dumming stood up.
"What the hell?"
The weight was Sean Wecker. His face snarled. Dumming walked away.
"Retard,"
Cody repeated.
"Chinese retard!"
It sounded like a ball, fleshy and raw. An animal turned inside out. In gym, they played kickball, a sport Deming had never played before. When it was his turn to kick, he heard a snicker and a voice go,
"Nice shoes."
He looked down at his new Nikes and the ball socked him in the gut. When he whirled around, he saw a row of boys trying not to laugh. After school, he walked home by himself. It wasn't that far, only a half hour. But the view was relentlessly unchanging. House after house, tree after tree. The tight streets unrolled into many fields, so vast that looking at them made him dizzy, frightened at the unendingness. As he got farther from school, the spaces between houses were bigger than the biggest houses themselves. He had grown so unaccustomed to hearing cars that when one drove past, he jumped. Passing the railroad tracks, he heard footsteps behind him and tightened his stance, anticipating Cody and his friends. A boy's voice said,
"Hey."
Deming lunged. But it wasn't Cody. It was a kid whom Deming had observed with curiosity. Roland Fuentes. He looked different than the other kids. He, too, wasn't one of them. Deming had heard people say Roland's last name with an exaggerated accent, drawing out the syllables like a mockery. Though Roland never reacted.
"Hey,"
he said now to Deming.
"I'm Roland. You're Daniel, right?"
Roland Fuentes was in the smart math class with the girl from the cafeteria, Emily Needles. He would have fit in fine in the city, but in Ridgeboro his speed and determination made him suspect. He jutted his chin forward as he moved, eyeballs darting like a nervous bird. His skin was browner than the bond paper white of Amber Bitburger and Sean Wecker, and his dark hair was baby fine and thinning. Or perhaps it had never filled in. If a boy could be balding before junior high. Together they crossed the tracks, kicking up gravel. No trains, to Dumming's knowledge, ever went through here.
"You in Dumkin's homeroom?"
"Yeah."
"I'm in Moore's."
Deming knew that but wasn't admitting it.
"Where do you live?"
"I live over on Sycamore."
"Near there," Deming said.
"On Oak. Where are you from?"
It didn't seem as annoying when it came from Roland.
"The city. The Bronx."
"Cool.
Where are you from?"
he asked.
"Mars!"
Roland was small, but his voice was the lowest out of all the boys, a scratchy, gravelly baritone.
"No. I'm from here.
Ridgeboro."
Roland said he and his mom lived on the corner of Sycamore and his dad was dead.
"But I don't remember him. He died when I was 3 1/2. In a car accident."
"My dad died too," Deming said. He suddenly wanted to be friends with Roland. To be friends with anyone. "In China."
"Did your mom die too? Your real mom?"
The word came out before he could stop it.
"Yeah."
At dinner, Peter asked if Deming had a good day at school, and Deming said yes. He made a friend. Kay asked if he liked his teachers, and he said they were okay. A little boring. She laughed and said,
"Lumpkin."
"What a name,"
said Peter.
"The kids must go to town on that one."
After dinner, Peter and Kay taught Deming gin rummy, and they sat together at the kitchen table and played cards until it got dark outside. Upstairs, in the silence of his room, Deming spoke Fujonese to his mother and told her he was sorry for saying she was dead. Roland and Deming had no classes together except for gym. But at recess they wolfed down their sandwiches and forsook the playground for the computer room, where crumbs and nerds of all grades played video games. Sometimes they'd see people in there they wouldn't have expected. Like Emily Needles. Or even once, Cody Campbell.
For 2 weeks, they dominated the top scores for all the games, beating their own records. No matter what game you played, you'd see only two names. D. Wilk and R. Fue. At first, Dumming had typed D. Guo. But Roland had asked,
"What's D. Guo?"
And it was too complicated to explain.
He'd written Dumming Guo on his worksheet the first day of school, and Mrs. Lumpkin had called him up to her desk after class.
"Is there a problem? Is this a joke?"
Whenever Dumming won another game, Roland held a hand out and said,
"Who's awesome? DWLK is awesome!"
Dumming returned the high five and glanced around the room, wishing Roland would keep it down. It wasn't safe to be bragging like that in Ridgeboro. And he didn't like how Roland jumped up and down when he typed in Arfue, pumping his fist in the air.
But between games, Dumming returned to the top scoreboards to look at the repetitions of a name that was supposed to be his.
In math, Mr. Moore drew obtuse angles, and Amber Bitburger chewed on the ends of her white-yellow hair.
"Stay awake," Dumming told himself. "Stay alert."
The easiest way to make sure he wouldn't get comfortable was to remember he was on a mission. That gin rummy and meatloaf and flannel blankets were a part of his investigation. If he held everyone at arm's length, it wouldn't hurt as much when they disappeared. After a few weeks, the wooden floors of the Wilkinsons' house no longer felt so slippery. And when people said, "Daniel," he answered, didn't think they were talking to someone else. No longer did Peter and Kay look as unusual to him, the shade of their skin and the shape of their noses as normal as the low buzz of the empty streets. And he didn't always remember to dial his mother's phone number at night. When he did, he always got the same message. "This call cannot be completed at this time." Now it was his face that seemed strange when he saw it in the mirror. He told himself his mission supervisors could come for him at any time, yank him out of class, drag him from the kickball game, approach him in the cafeteria as he ate PBJ on wheat, seemingly unaware. For he could never be unaware. There was always the possibility that one afternoon there would be his mother, or Leon, or even Vivian in the cafeteria, ready to pick him up and bring him home. A rap on the door at homeroom. Daniel Wilkinson excused as the rest of the class murmured, "Ooh," like he was in trouble. And in the principal's chair would be Mama, her face a warm light, apologizing for taking so long, rolling her eyes behind Principal Chester's back. They would jump on the next bus to the city, and Dumming could clear the lint from his throat, loosen his milk-coated tongue. It wasn't his mother or Vivian who came to the Wilkinsons' house one Friday, but a freckled white woman with a button nose and a small cup of a chin, hair springing from her face in toast-colored coils.
"I'm Miss Barry," she said, "but you can call me Jamie."
"Jamie is our caseworker from the foster care agency," Peter said.
The woman turned to Dumming.
"Do you want to show me your room?"
"Go ahead, Daniel," Kay said. Jamie followed Dumming upstairs and sat on the floor, against his bed. She looked at the plastic trucks.
"Are these your toys?"
"Yeah."
"Do you want to show me how they work?"
"Not really."
"Okay, that's fine." Jamie smiled. "How's school going? Have you made any friends?"
"Yeah. Roland."
"Do you want to tell me about him?"
"He's a boy."
"I know you've been through a lot of big changes recently, but whatever you want to tell me, it's between me and you. And you don't have to say anything if you don't want to."
"Okay."
"What's your favorite subject at school?"
"I don't know."
What about your least favorite subject?
All of them? Math, I guess.
In the empty playground, the weary's swing had creaked as Dumming's mother swayed. This was last November, 3 months before she left.
Eek! Eek! Eek!
It went.
Eek! Eek! Eek!
Dumming leaned, palms on her back, but he couldn't get her that high. Up, down, curving behind him and sweeping forward, her jacket a silver dollar against the gray sky. She had yelped into the clouds.
Ha! Ha!
He pushed her until she said, "Enough! Your turn!" She lifted one leg, then the other, patting the saggy U of the rubber seat. He sat, legs dangling.
"Ready?"
Up he went. Higher. Swing squealing past the pockmarked asphalt. The slide flaked with curls of rust. A hot glob of lunch dribbled up inside him, and the next thing he knew he was no longer clutching the chains but flying, soaring like a brick. And before he smacked into the asphalt, he saw the pavement tilt sideways, blotting his vision. A concrete eclipse. He'd awoken in a strange room with the worst headache of his life. Lying on a cot next to another cot with an old man in a diaper and an IV drip. Mold stains blotched across the ceiling tiles. He heard crying babies and saw white static. A sign on the wall said, "Urgent care." His mother flipped through a magazine. When she saw him moving, she jumped up, grabbed his hand. "You're awake!"
"What happened?"
"You slipped, kid." She squeezed his hand harder.
"I did.
I was so scared. You were out for a minute. Seemed like forever. How are you feeling? Are you hungry?" A nurse spoke about recovery. Said Dumming should rest. Here were white pills to take, and he needed to drink them with water. He looked at his mother's pouched and tired face, the brown splat of mole on her neck. And his eyes filled with bright, stabbing light. When he closed them, he saw dark stars, and he questioned what he remembered. Maybe she pushed him too hard, or maybe he'd jumped, heeding an urge to leap and flap. Superhero dreams. Leon had said it was an accident. Dumming was a big boy, and big boys didn't get hurt easily.
"Got to be more careful next time. Boys are energetic. Hard to keep you still."
At the apartment, Dumming woke again to his mother, at the edge of his bed, watching him in the dark.
"Mama?"
In the yellowy shadows of the streetlights filtering through the curtains, he saw the outline of her nose and chin, hair matted and uneven from sleep. She ran her nails against his scalp, scratching lightly. He heard her whisper, "It's important to be strong." Dumming and Kay watched the other moms across the parking lot of Ridgeboro Middle School. Their baggy, shin-length pants, mushroomy haircuts, and pastel cardigans. The other moms matched. Their kids did, too. Other moms attended PTA meetings, had gone to one another's baby showers, were elated when they found out their sons and daughters would one day be classmates. Ridgeboro parents worked at the hospital or in the prison, and none of the other kids had a mother and a father who both taught at a college. The other moms stood in a tight circle by their cars, their voices jigsawing across the asphalt. They talked about their husbands and children, made plans with one another's families for the upcoming weekend. And Dumming noticed a hungry look on Kay's face as she shook her keys. "They're probably discussing scrapbooking and cookie recipes," she said. "And voting Republican, for whoever their husbands vote for." Like him, Kay was a crumb. And like him,